this week on Tales from the South. It's an encore presentation of our Tin Roof Project number 4, featuring well-known Southern musician, dancer, and entertainer, Lawrence Hamilton.
We were pulled over by the local police. I was so afraid because this was 1972. We were black, and this was the South.
This was our 4th Tin Roof Project, and it was recorded on December 7th, 2010, and aired a month later on January 6th, 2011.
And the bus was filled with people from Washington, D.C. and Arkansas who came to view the fruits of their labor. These guests included the Secretary of Agriculture at the time, Orville Freeman, and then Arkansas Governor Orville Faubus. It would be years before I would understand the significance of that moment.
Sit back, relax, and enjoy some Southern-style storytelling as we go to Starving Artist Cafe in North Little Rock, Arkansas, and Paula Morrell.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to a special edition of Tales from the South. Tonight we have our monthly Tin Roof Project, where a well-known Southerner brings his own true story to life. I'm your host, Paula Morrell. How's everybody doing tonight? To my left here, playing the blues for us tonight in every show, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. And during dinner, we had our house band, the incredible Mockingbird Hillbilly Band. Check out their website at mockingbirdhillbillyband.com. And back behind me is our set by esteemed Arkansas artist B.L. Cox. These incredible, genuine screen doors with mixed media portraiture are from her Images of the American South collection. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. More can be seen at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? The career of tonight's storyteller has been paved with bold and creative achievements worldwide. Lawrence Hamilton was born in 1954 in Foreman, Arkansas. He attended the Foreman Public Schools and received a Bachelor of Music Education degree from Henderson State University in Arkadelphia, Arkansas. While performing at Walt Disney World in Orlando, Florida, he was discovered by talent manager Tommy Molinaro, who invited him to come to New York to audition for famed New York actor-director Jeffrey Holder. Thus began his fantastic journey. He has performed as a dancer with Ballet Tap USA, the Brooklyn Dance Theater, and Southern Ballet Theater. He has worked as a vocal coach and arranger with many artists in the recording industry, including Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch, Mark Wahlberg, the New Kids on the Block, Jordan Knight, and Joe McIntyre. Lawrence has served as musical director for opera diva Jesse Norman in Jesse Norman Sings for the Healing of AIDS, which included performances by Elton John, Whoopi Goldberg, Toni Morrison, Max Roach, Bill T. Jones, Anna DeVere Smith, and a 60-voice choir. He has performed in concert with the legendary Lena Horne, for President and Mrs. Ronald Reagan at the White House, for Ambassador and Mrs. Thomas Pickering at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, and for Pope John Paul II at the Vatican. Lawrence has not yet won a Tony, but he was nominated for the equivalent given to touring performance. He also has been named Distinguished Alumni and Distinguished Black Alumni of his alma mater. He's been inducted into the Arkansas Entertainers Hall of Fame and the Arkansas Black Hall of Fame. And he's got a street named after him in his hometown. Lawrence is a self-described country boy who's lived in the city his whole life. He is currently working on his memoir entitled In an Ordinary Life. And he has worked on a story from that memoir to read tonight for Tales from the South, where he'll take us to his hometown, memories of giving, and a long-forgotten letter to a Texas judge in No Greater Love. Ladies and gentlemen, Lawrence Hamilton.
Come and listen to my story about it. No, just joking. I'm so happy to be here. And I used to laugh at my friends when they had to put these on. It's come to this. It was 1972, and I was a freshman at Henderson State University in Arkadelphia, Arkansas. My older brother had just gotten a brand new car, and he and my younger brother picked me up to take me home for the weekend to Foreman, a town in the southwestern part of Arkansas with a population of 1,001 people. I was so excited to ride in my older brother's shiny new car. The trip went great until we got to the exit at New Boston, Texas, which led directly into Foreman. As we approached the exit, we were pulled over by the local police. I was so afraid because this was 1972. We were black, and this was the South. I am the fifth of seven children. Up until the time I was about 6 or 7 years old, we lived in this small six-room, 10-room house. Oh, how I loved it when it rained. My parents had one bedroom. My three older brothers shared another, and I shared the last bedroom with my two sisters and my younger brother. There was also a front porch, a back porch, and a kitchen. There was no indoor plumbing. A trip to the outhouse was always exciting. I saw many snakes cross my path, and the Sears and JCPenney catalogs were a good way to wish for toys and clothes. They also served as toilet paper. Water had to be boiled for bathing and washing clothes, but I had a ball. I was so excited the day my dad brought home a beautiful collie puppy, which I promptly named Rennie, after the famous Ren 10-10. Oh, the fun I had playing with Rennie. One day while playing in the front yard, Rennie ran into the graveled road and was struck by a speeding car that crushed his hindquarters. My eyes filled with tears as I picked him up and carried him out to the road, and I thought he was going to die, but thank God he didn't. With seven kids, my parents couldn't afford a veterinarian. I had never heard of that word. So my dad built him a sling in hopes that his wounds would heal and his legs would get better. It didn't happen. Although my dad tried every remedy he knew to try and save my Rennie, the flies bred in his wounds, and to end his suffering, my dad put him down. I always remember the look in his eyes as he was about to leave me. I loved him so much. And so did my dad. When I was 6 or 7 years old, we moved into a brand new house on the 40 acres he and my mom had bought across the street. My dad and my brother Dale had worked fearlessly to finish the interior. But with a new house came new rules. No shoes in the house. You never went into the former living room or my parents' bedroom. Your bed had to be made as soon as your feet hit the floor in the morning. Do your homework and make good grades. Cleanliness was a must, both personally and when cleaning the dishes. The kitchen wasn't clean until the floor was swept and mopped. One day during my week on kitchen duty, my dad came in while I was doing the dishes after a big family dinner. He touched the water and found it had gotten a bit cool and made me wash every dish and pot over. He and my mom made sure we did things right always. Shoes shined, hair combed, and we always had to say yes, sir, and yes, ma'am. It always bothered me somehow that little white boys and girls got to call my parents and grandparents by their first name. But my favorite thing was the fact that we had two indoor bathrooms. No need for JCPenney's or Sears catalogs, and yes, you really wanted them in there. We had toilet paper. Plop, plop, fizz, fizz, oh, what a relief it is. One day not long after we moved into our new house, a huge bus pulled up in front of the house. Of course, shoes were shined, hair was neat, clothes perfect. Who were these people who made us wear our Sunday best on a Wednesday? You see, my parents had bought the 40 acres and built the house with the help of the FHA. And the bus was filled with people from Washington, D.C. and Arkansas who came to view the fruits of their labor. These guests included the Secretary of Agriculture at the time, Orville Freeman, and then Arkansas Governor Orville Faubus. It would be years before I would understand the significance of that moment. I sat there on the sofa in the den with my brothers and sisters and stood politely and shook hands as they passed by. When they had left, the Sunday clothes and shoes immediately came off and I went out to play. Unity Elementary and High School was where I attended school until 1970. The school was just one huge white building where all classes were taught, first grade through 12. Looking back now, I wonder how we survived it, but it worked. My dad was the principal, and my mom was in charge of the cafeteria. After preparing breakfast for us at home, she always left early to get food ready for lunch at school. Oh, how I loved the rolled oats confection she made called shortenbread. Apple crisp was another one of my favorites. Thank you, chef, tonight. My dad was in charge of everything else from hiring teachers, organizing buses and drivers, food for the cafeteria, running the small office, and yes, discipline. I never wanted to get in trouble at school because the punishment would be double. School was from 8:15 until 3:15. I would stay behind with my dad and play under the huge pine trees that lined the campus. We called it the Grove. The older kids would use it for strolling and courting while we stayed to play on the playground. One day while playing with my friends in the second grade class, a huge truck appeared filled with pianos. My dad called me over and asked if I would like one. I said, yeah, and politely ran off to join my friends on the playground. I was amazed to find a beautiful upright piano sitting in the living room when I got home. I could finally go into the former living room. I began to play the keys and was able to figure out the tune, Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. I started formal lessons with three wonderful women, Miss Cassie Wright, Miss Leola Hatton, who was a contemporary of Scott Joplin, and Miss Delilah Gully. In 1970, schools were integrated, and I was a little scared. I didn't know what would happen, but found out that it worked out fine. Dad became the assistant superintendent, and Mom continued to work in food services. I made new friends, joined the band and the glee club, and continued to study the piano. In 1972, I graduated with honors from Foreman High School. And with my piano studies, I landed a piano scholarship to the great Henderson State University. Wow, college. The day finally came to leave, and Mom and Dad drove me to Arkadelphia to get oriented and to settle in. I was filled with amazement and wondered if I would fit in. I joined the symphonic and marching bands, the collegiate choir, drama, and of course studied the piano. Although 16 or 17 credit hours were a regular load, I sometimes had 21 or more. My parents were concerned, but I did fine. Because of this, I wasn't allowed to come home many weekends as they wanted me to stay and study. On Friday evening, after everyone was gone, I would put a rock to gently open the door to the Russell Fine Arts Building so I could return after dinner to practice the piano and the organ. Dad would come through on his way to meetings and visit me. It still makes me smile when he would give me $2 and tell me not to spend it all in one place. I love my parents so much. To make extra money, I played for the St. Paul AME Church Youth Choir, which was considered one of the best in the state. And then came the night we got pulled over. Apparently, my brother's shiny new car had a light out, and they wanted to give him a ticket. They approached us both on both sides with their flashlights and saw an empty beer can my brother had left under the seat days earlier. They told us that that would be a $150 fine for the offense. We collected just that amount from our pockets and were mortified when they told us that it would be $150 each. I knew and felt that I was never going to see my parents again. They had worked so hard to make sure we were good people and always do the right thing. I was on my way home to celebrate being in college and being home, and they threw my little brother and I in a filthy jail. I was 17 years old, and my brother was 15. As there were no cell phones back then, my older brother drove the 16 miles to Foreman to alert my parents. We were so scared. When my parents arrived and saw that we were locked in a cell with a sleeping drunk man, my mom possessed the wrath of a lioness defending her cubs. She demanded that they release us immediately, and putting her fingers in the officer's face, told him, "As long as you live, you never put one of my children in this filthy jail." She was crying, and I grabbed her and started to cry as well. I assured her that we were fine. In the meantime, they had awakened the sleepy old Texas judge, and my dad kept asking him, "What did they do?" He couldn't afford this fine, but if we were going to be set free, he had to pay. We finally left and went home completely devastated. Years later, after my dad passed away, my mom asked me to help clean out his closet. There were many interesting things found there: Indian head, nickels, a certificate drawn on the Bank of the United States worth $1,000, and a letter to that old sleepy Texas judge, imploring him to change his mind and asking for his money to be returned. Again, I started to cry as I read the note and realized that there is no greater love. Thank you.
Welcome, Lawrence Hamilton, to Tales from the South.
Thank
you so much for coming tonight. Your story is full of stories of what your dad gave you: the puppy Rennie, the new house, the beautiful upright piano, $2 not to spend in one place, and of course, paying the fine to get you out of jail. So while he was a very strict disciplinarian, he was also very giving. So is this how you would characterize your father?
Both my father and my mother were both totally giving, loving. They had seven of us, and they put us all through school. So I always was amazed as to how he could do that on a school teacher's salary. That's why the $2 had to be spent in 15 places. But I'm... My dad and my parents are my heroes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how I would be sitting right here right now because without their love and support. Mm-hmm. So giving is the word.
Mm-hmm. It's wonderful. And so when you were in the second grade, you came home to find a beautiful upright piano in your living room. Did either of your parents or your brothers and sisters play that piano?
No, I was the only one, and I was amazed because they named me Lawrence Olivier Hamilton. So when I got home, I was just amazed. And I guess parents see things in their children and they guide them and help them to be what they want to be. That's the one thing. The only time I felt excommunicated from my parents is when I was I graduated from Henderson State University, and I worked at, some of you may remember, a restaurant called Jacques and Suzanne.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
So I trained to be a waiter there for a week. And then some friends that in Florida called me and asked me if I wanted to be a part of their dinner theater to sing every day. And I said, sure, I don't want to wait tables. So, but that's the other joke in New York City. They say, I'm an actor, and they say, what restaurant do you work at?
Sure, yeah.
So I went to Florida for the summer, and then in the meantime, in Arkadelphia, Arkansas, there was Peak Middle School, and they wanted me, Randy Muse wanted me to come to be director of music, to be a positive role model for young African-American kids. So it broke my dad's heart when I turned it down, and I said, Dad, I think I'm going to go to Disney World, because they called. And he said these words, and I'll always remember, he says, all right, son, you're on your own now. No! What if I make a mistake? But that piano led me to many great journeys. I mean, I'd love to hear Miss Leola Hatton, who was from Texarkana. She was a contemporary of Scott Joplin, and at the end of my lessons, she would sit and play ragtime for me. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what it was. I just knew I loved it. Mm-hmm. But that piano led me to this point right now. And it's still sitting in the house down in Foreman right now.
Oh, good. I was going to ask.
But it's covered with grandkids' pictures and graduation.
Well, good. Now, I love the line in your story where you wrote, we lived in a small six-room, tin-roof house. Oh, how I loved it when it rained. And I love that sound, too. And the reason why we call this the Tin Roof Project is because tin roof, the sound of rain on a tin roof, reminds me of storytelling. We used to go down to my uncle's fish camp and tell stories. And that sound reminds me of storytelling. So hence the name, the Tin Roof Project. So what sound would you say that sounds like? In other words, what musical instrument would you say?
Several musical instruments, because as you know, when it rains, it's slow, mm-hmm. and then it gets fast and hard. So the difference in the crescendos, it almost was like being at the ocean and hearing the waves come in. Mm-hmm. But it's some of the best sleeping weather in life. I never wanted it to stop raining, mm-hmm. because I could lay there and just hear it just softly humming and hitting the roof. And then it would pound like timpani. Mm-hmm. And then you could hear it sometimes feel like a harp or a piano just gently striking the roof.
Yeah.
When I build me a new house, I'm going to put a tin roof on it.
Oh, absolutely. So do you think that it was an inspiration for your music and your dance? Do you think that sound was?
Oh, definitely. I mean that nature is music, whether you believe that or not. When I look at the moon every night, my mom and dad taught me a little song called I See the Moon. Well, I wrote the music to it. And the moon sees me. God bless the moon and God bless me. God bless the love of my family. The most precious gift you gave to me. But every night when I look at the moon and see the sky... When I see the moon and the stars, there's music. Mm. When I see friends having a good time like we are tonight, that's music. When I can tell my brothers and sisters and my friends that I love them, that's music. And hearing the rain on a tin roof is definitely music.
Okay, we have just a few minutes to open up for audience questions.
What's next in your career?
And next in my career, I'm trying to finish this book. It's called In an Ordinary Life. My life has been very ordinary, but extraordinary at the same time. So, and I want to teach kids and have them to know that they can achieve whatever they want. I come from a town of 1,001 people. Many of us have come from small towns and succeeded, but today, they don't know who Colin Powell is. They don't know the things that we would think they would know. They don't remember when the Voting Rights Act was passed. And coming from a small town, I said, you're crazy. My mom and dad went through Hades to get me where I am. And now you expect it to happen. You expect it. Black, white, Latino, Asian, everybody. We expect it to happen. And I believe that you have to work at it. I'm still working at it. I hope you all see me in a new movie soon.
I was just wondering, what happened that made your father realize that you would have an affinity for music to even ask you if you wanted a piano?
You know, I'm still amazed. She asked what made my father know that I had an affinity to music. I don't know. To this day, my grandmother left me 3 years ago at 108 years old. And she outlived both my parents, everybody always tells me that I have good genes, and I said I'd have a nice pair of Levi's in my closet. But it's just a thing whereby I don't know. Maybe because he felt there was a need for musicians, as there is today. If I had my way, I would start an organ scholarship in the name of my teacher at Henderson State University, Robert Ellis, in the name of my late voice teacher who we buried last week, Eugene Kuiper. And I would make sure, I want, you know, maybe this is the room to ask. I want to build a brand new Center for Cultural Diversity where kids can come and learn about everything.
Yeah.
About everything. I'm going to be calling on you for some donations.
What did the rain sound like whenever it was patting on your roof?
She said, what did the rain sound like? It's sounding like something probably like this. Go to sleep, little baby, sleep. No, it was a beautiful, beautiful sound. One day, you know, you'll get to experience that tin roof sound.
Well, thank you so much, Lawrence Hamilton, for reading your true story, No Greater Love, on Tales from the South. You can find out more about Lawrence on his website, lawrencehamilton.com. Thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tonight has been brought to you by the Argenta Arts Foundation. Additional support provided by Lehman Library and the Winthrop Rockefeller Institute. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website. We are open for submissions from Southerners. For more information, visit talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of downtown North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation in North Little Rock, Arkansas. Discover more at argentaartsdistrict.org. Our executive producer and host is Paula Morrell. Our production engineer is Jay Jones. And our assistant editor is Stephanie Trevino. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.